You're listening to For the Republic, a love letter to Star Wars animation.
Hello there.
All right, everyone, welcome back to our Mandalorian recaps here on For the Republic, a love letter to Star Wars animation. It is Don and Andrew back here once again to talk about Chapter 18 of The Mandalorian, The Mines of Mandalore. And what an episode this was. Let me just say that right off the bat. Like, you want to talk about, like, changing the way, like, the Mandalorian formula is? Look no further than this episode, because this was something I didn't think we were going to get. Until like 3-4 episodes into the season, we get it right off the bat. In the second episode, we're immediately moving here. And then just the way the episode just goes down was so different than I was expecting. And it ended with a truly amazing turn of events, which we will get into for sure.
My mind is still reeling from that last moment.
I am just so excited to talk about that one because it's something I never really thought we would see. And yet, here we are.
The second episode.
I know, it's crazy. I just want to say, before we get started, I just wanted to point out that, remember that these Mando recaps are dropping on Fridays now, and our Bad Batch recaps are dropping on Saturday. Just a fair warning, though, we did pre-record the Bad Batch episode yesterday, which is Wednesday, just because I have things going on Friday, wasn't able to make it to the normal recording session. And just a fair warning, if you're watching on video this week, my video is all wonky because my internet and StreamYard screwed me over. And I was like, it's just good. It's going to look fine in the recording because it looks fine on my end. It did not. So fair warning there. I have an editor's note there. I tried to clean up as much as I could. But maybe go for the audio version for the Bad Batch episode this week. But still, check out the recap because the Outpost was such an amazing episode, and I can't wait for you guys to listen to our discussion on that one.
Incredible episode with possibly the worst Imperial officer ever put to animation.
100%, but also
Lieutenant Nolan, what a prick.
I can't stand him, but also maybe the best, like, jumping out of my seat and cheering moment in the entire series.
I was so happy.
We talked at great length about that on that recap, which you can check out tomorrow when this episode is being posted. So check that out. But let's get into the mines. We start things off, and we're on Tatooine. We do not see Boba Fett, which was a little upsetting, but we do see Pelimoto and all the droids. We get the pit droids back. We get the little BD unit. And of course, we get R5, who has a much more expanded role now going forward, which I'm sure makes some original trilogy fans very excited. I'm still, to be honest, kind of like, I don't know what to think about it, if I'm being of R5 being Mando's astromech droid. Because I think it's like, it's kind of hilarious that he's still like super skittish and stuff has changed, but I'm also like, is this just like fan service for the sake of fan service? And it's like, oh, you know, we liked this character when we saw this movie back in 1977, so that means everyone does. Like, I
think
can't
a little
tell.
Bit, but like, also, I feel like it does. If you want to dig it a bit deeper, it does also kind of rhyme with Din having the N1 Starfighter because it's an older model, an older ship that he's tuned up and has given a new purpose. And you can kind of say the same of R5. He's a skittish droid. He's somewhat falling apart. He's a little rickety, but he still has his uses. And he is reformatted for a new purpose here because we see him like sort of gradually get more comfortable in the mission. Like he proves his usefulness in unexpected ways, shall we say?
Yes. Yeah, I do like that he's here. And I think the fact that they're like showing him every time you go to Peli's like garage, like it makes sense for him to like start doing something. But again, I'm still trying to figure that out. We were talking about from a certain point of view before we started recording because the Return of the Jedi book just got announced. I know he does have a pretty good story in the A New Hope one. So
he does indeed. It's a good one, yeah.
So I would maybe recommend if you're a big R5 fan,
definitely
reading that story after these Mando episodes, because I think it might help with his characterization a lot more in this episode.
Yeah, he's a he's brave in spite of himself, I will say, like in spite of the hardships he faces. And I suppose that's probably why I have some investment in that little droid after reading that story, because he's had a hard life, and I can see why he would want to just chill in Pelly's hangar, really. But
yeah,
it's cool to see him answer the call to adventure, albeit in a slightly reluctant way. My favorite bit was when he just he has to like trundle off, and Mando is just like, "Don't be a baby."
that was great.
A funny moment
when he's just like wandering around the Mandalore, and he's just like, I don't really want to do this. It's like, no, I need the samples.
This place is scary. It's all like, it looks like explosions have been frozen. I don't like it.
Yeah, I would be like, if we got like just a quick scenario of like, what would his voice sound like in that scenario? Like, if you could understand R5, it would just be like,
I don't like this. He'd probably have a voice like Piglet from Winnie the Pooh, like, oh, deer.
Oh, yeah, 100%. That's actually just Piglet. It's like Meeber Gascon when he's inside the one astro droid in the G Squad. It's just Piglet inside R5. One question I have for you though is because Din went back to Tatooine to get the memory core for IG-11, and then ended up getting R5 instead. Do you think they're just like moving on with this, or do you think we're gonna go back?
I think we are going to go back because it's too specific a plot point to just bring up and then spend so much time on and then just ignore. Like, I feel like they wanted to clearly, I'm really glad that they just forged ahead with going to Mandalore, because it's a really nice change of pace from like the previous two seasons. You know, aside the quick trip to Tython aside, like it's just a really refreshing thing to do, because like, you'd assume we would spend the whole series doing that, but I feel like they are building towards more stuff with IG-11. We know we're going to see the droid bar later on. That feels very tied to that. So I imagine IG-11 is probably going to wind up serving a purpose that's different to what Din originally intended for him, I would say.
Yeah, I hope that's the case. I think the fact that like we spent so much of the first episode on IG-11 for them to just be like, okay, no, new droid instead. It's another recognizable one that we know. Let's go.
And we are going back to Navarre. Like, there's footage from the trailer that shows like a battle there, and there's more footage of the Anzellans. So I think it's safe to assume that's coming back.
More Anzellans. But
we should talk about Pelimoto as well.
Oh, like, I love her.
She came back. Oh, she's great. I love that she has been in so many episodes. Yeah, I've got Lego Peli as well. I love that she's been in so many episodes of both Mandalorian and Book of Boba Fett. She's just such a fun character. Amy Sedaris is just like so full of personality in the role.
And also like, every time I see the BD droid, I freak out because I'm like, this is not real. And
gasped when that little droid walked into view in the Book of Boba Fett, seriously. But yeah, Peli, I can't get enough of her. And like, like, I'll never get tired of hearing her speak Jawa. Like, that's just great. So funny. Like, and I love the hustle thing that she has going with the Jawas.
I wonder if any of those Jawas is the one that she has the past relationship with that she mentioned. I wonder if there's some...
I've dated a Jawa. They're very furry. Very furry.
The one thing that stuck out to me about this scene, I love that it was just like this like almost cold open on Tatooine. Like, we go there, he gets the droid, he leaves, we're off to the mine. So I thought it was a great way of telling the story. And I also loved the whole fireworks scene. They really showed that off in the trailers a lot. And just seeing Grogu look through the N1's little dome at the fireworks looked great. The one thing, maybe it's just me, that just never put this together as a Star Wars fan, but like, them, like Pelly, and it's probably been a thing forever, but I just put the pieces together now. Pelly referring to like Boon to Eve as like a holiday and like it being a huge thing. I just never put it together that Boon to Eve was a holiday. Yeah. I thought it was just like, oh, the Boon to Eve Classic. It's just a race. It's just a pod race name. But it's a huge day for them. It's like, oh yeah, everyone gets really drunk during Boonta. And I'm like,
yeah.
Are they making this up or has this always been a thing? But like she does
I
little,
love that.
I don't know. Maybe that was just me like something that should be really obvious, but like me watching it, I was like, wait, is this a holiday? Or are they just saying shit? And I'm like, guess it is.
I loved the speeders as well, like just sort of having a like there was sort of like a speeder
that was so
race
fun.
Going on in the background. Yeah.
They really made Tatooine seem super lively in this one scene alone.
And it gave the sense that Boba Fett's reign there has really helped the planet out, similar to how Greef Karga's what the work he has done with Navarro has made that planet thrive. So I do think we'll probably see Boba Fett again, at least, like maybe get at least a little bit of an episode showing him there and showing how like Mos Espa is continuing and Mos Eisley are both continuing to prosper under his supervision for sure. As for why he's not here now, my headcanon is that he and Fennec got married and are having a honeymoon on the Halcyon.
Ooh. Well, let's see. Get the Star Cruiser in there. I do like how he was mentioned though. I think it might have maybe stopped the episode dead if we had like a whole combo between Din and Boba Fett. I think that's coming later in the season because I do think Temuera Morrison is going to be back. But it was nice to be back on Tatooine even briefly. I'm actually kind of glad it was just the very beginning of the episode and not full on we're going to have an episode on Tatooine. Because while I do like the Mando episodes on Tatooine, save for the Gunslinger, but like Pelimoto is increasingly becoming one of my favorite characters in the show. And then just they tend to show off a different aspect of Tatooine every single time. It would have been cool to maybe get a Cobb Vanth reference. But again, there's more episodes down the line. We'll see where that goes. Moving on to Mandalore, though. I still cannot believe that we got Mandalore in live action and that it looked this good. It looked so freaking good. Like, it looked just like how we saw it in the Clone Wars and in Rebels.
Yeah.
But completely just devastated, deserted. The Empire has just turned it into ruins. Like, there's a lot of great lines from Bo-Katan. Like, this used to be a thriving city, a thriving planet. Now it's a tomb.
Yeah, very, and very Lord of the Rings, really. Exactly. Like, when they go into... there's a lot of... it's kind of an illusion, really, with the title, but it's very Minds of Moria, with this haunting environment that's like used to be this thriving kingdom and is now just like so full of like death and darkness and foreboding. It was really cool, and as you said, it's just like the fact that we have Mandalore, that we went inside Sundari and we saw all of like. Like, yeah, it's all bombed and, like, wrecked, and the lighting is all, like, dark. But it was the architecture was there. That is the designs we've seen in the Clone Wars, because we've been there so many times. And it was just, it's a very melancholy experience, for sure. So, it's a change of pace, again, for the Mandalorian to kind of spend that much time on that kind of subject matter and to brilliantly transition from a humorous like fun opening with Pelly on Tatooine to then going to this, and like the like just from the moment of like them breaching the atmosphere, which was felt very Empire Strikes Back to me, like when the N1 is flying through the storm clouds and then that burst of synth when they break the clouds, that felt so that if anything felt like a Kevin Kiner move really with the score, and it just kind of it gave me a shiver that whole thing.
It was such a great introduction to the planet once again. And like we arrived there, and as we mentioned, they Din has R5 do these air samples just to make sure that it's breathable, because for years he had heard his cult had taught him that Mandalore, the planet, had been poisoned by the Empire. And a lot of this episode's theme has to do with these, like, so-called myths. And a lot of stuff that, like, Din heavily believes in because of his background and how he was raised. And Bo-Katan believes to be nothing more than fables and stories used to attract tourists. And yet, as we find out in this episode, some of those are, in fact, myths. And some of those are way more than meets the eye.
Definitely.
It's a great way to end the episode off. R5, he's getting his little samples there and just disappears. They got to find him, but they realize that, hey, the air, actually, you can breathe it. Bo-Katan was right. Maybe I am in a cult, but he still doesn't want to admit it yet.
It's a bit of a himbo move from Din, isn't it? Yeah. Like, right off the bat. Like, he could have just pressurized the helmet and gone out with R5. But he's like, you know what? I don't really want to.
Din is in prime drip. Himbo mode in this episode. He's in prime damsel or Jaren in distress energy.
Jaren in distress. I love that. That needs to become a thing, Andrew,
his
for sure.
His kid saves him. His star-crossed Mando lover saves him. I'm starting to ship it. I'm not even gonna lie.
I was shipping it like months in advance, but
two this week. Crosshair and Mayday, and now this, where I'm like, yeah. You might have got me, Lucasfilm. But
yeah,
they are attacked by these creatures. We did see them in the trailer, but Din was having a little bit of trouble with them. And again, like last week when it was IG-11 when he like reactivated and went to his default program. I'm like, Din, you got the Darksaber. Just pull that thing out. He's starting with the blaster, but he eventually does move in with the Darksaber. He still is having, I love though, how every time he uses it, he's still like not fully all the way there yet. It's still super heavy for him.
Yeah.
He still is like trying to get it. And
there was a really good tweet from Mo, who's a friend of the podcast, who she tweeted that it kind of shows that Din is still not in full alignment with himself. Yeah. And I replied with like, yeah, it's because he is meant for greater things than what he is currently aiming for. And it's almost like because the Kyber crystals within the lightsabers are attuned with the Force and are kind of alive themselves in a sense. It's almost like the saber can sense that Din is resisting his greater calling. Like he's clearly meant for so much more than being just a part of the Children of the Watch, and the saber can kind of sense that. Like his commitment, his stubborn adherence to the Children of the Watch, is why he's struggling to lift the Darksaber.
Every episode that passes, I have to stop myself further and further from buying a replica Darksaber. I already have a lamp of the Darksaber that I have in my room that's super cool, but I need just one that I can swing. And I told myself that my next one is for sure Leia's, but I'm like, if I can find a better deal on the Darksaber, I might have to...
It'd be pretty sick. You get to rule Mandalore with it.
Exactly.
So like...
I get to rule Mandalore, and then if someone beats me in combat, they get to rule Mandalore. It'll be like that meme when like the Amazon delivery driver brings the Darksaber and doesn't realize he has to take part in ritual combat. It's like, sorry, sir, I have to beat you in order to obtain this Darksaber. I need to do this. But again, I can't get over how cool it looked, and eventually he was able to take out those beasts, but they keep coming back throughout the episode. One in more intimidating fashion, the other in quite hilarious fashion.
Yeah.
We will get to that eventually. Again,
they're very good design, aren't they? The Alamites, yeah. I have to say. Like they're that really good mix of like, I mean, I was reminded of the Morlocks from like the H.G. Wells' Time Machine movie adaptation very much. They've got the glowing eyes and the kind of like creepy look, the subterranean
look. I haven't seen the movie. So
I've read the book as well, but like I used to watch The Big Bang Theory, I don't anymore, but like when I used to watch The Big Bang Theory, there was a gag involving the Morlocks and the Time Machine, and it's a very similar design with the with the Alamites. They're very kind of, they're like I said, they have the glowing eyes. They have that kind of pale white skin, the subterranean look. They're just, they seem a bit more thuggish though with the weapons, which was interesting. And it's cool to learn that they're actually, they aren't simply like raiders or like mutated. They are part, they've been part of Mandalore. And as fearsome as they are, it's a continued thread that there is still life on Mandalore.
Yeah, maybe, they were natives on the planet, and then they were able to survive the, what are they calling it now? Is it the Night of a Thousand Tears?
The Night of a Thousand Tears, yeah, the fusion bombs that crystallize the planet's surface, which I have to say, it's weirdly beautiful, the surface of Mandalore. Like it's horrific, the scarring of the planet, but there's a kind of weird beauty in the way that the crystal formations have kind of formed, the kind of like green glinting in the sun. It was it's an interesting image for sure.
I'm still just shocked how well it's been adapted to live action. Even just for like just when they saw Sindari in the Civic Center, it just looked so cool. I was like, oh my god, that is Clone Wars right there. I'm thinking back to the teen episodes. I'm thinking back to Death Watch. I'm like, I am getting so excited here. But I love
even the sewers looked accurate.
The sewers looked accurate. I'm like, Maul just attacked Jesse in here somewhere. Like, help me out here, buddy. But I love these little combos with Din and Grogu. Like, you know, this is the home of our people. But he's like, and he's talking about all this Mandalorian lore, but he's like, this is my first time here too. I've never been here before. So it just shows how disconnected he still is from a lot of Mandalorian culture, even though he's so much about, the creed and the way, and, you know, I can't take my helmet off. I need to be redeemed. I need to soak in the living waters. And even later in the episode, when Bo-Katan makes him that soup, he's like, oh, you've never had this soup? It's like every Mandalorian has had this pog soup in their life. And he's like, I don't know what the hell this is. And I was like, and he just like helmet.
Sheepishly sips it.
It's like Pedro Pascal wasn't on set for this episode, I guess. So we can't have him take the helmet off for this scene.
There's also that other scene where I'm kind of skeptical if Pedro was there for filming. Just out of curiosity.
I guess we'll find out eventually. One thing we brought this up last week, but I do love how Brendan Wayne and Lateef Crowder are getting starring credits this season, finally.
I'm so happy for that, for them.
So because just they, to show that, like, hey, all of these different actors went into creating this character of Din Djarin.
Exactly.
And even though we know him as Pedro, it's like there are multiple people that go into the creating of the character, and it's more than just a stunt double at this point. Or a body double. Like, we're going to credit them, which I really enjoy, and I thought that was a really cool idea.
And it's authentic to Star Wars as well. Like it's a tradition, if anything, because it's what happened with Vader. Like, you know, obviously most people, when they talk about the performance of Darth Vader, they talk about James Earl Jones's iconic voice. And it's for a reason, because his voice was incredible. But, you know, it wasn't solely James Earl Jones who brought Vader to life. It was David Prowse's physical performance in the suit. It was the stuntman, Bob Peterson, I believe was his name, who did the fights in Empire. Like, there's a lot of collaboration that went into making Vader as iconic as he is. And it's carried forward now with Mando. And it's
to a lesser extent with Boba Fett as well in the original trilogy, where Jeremy Bullock was in the suit, but there were different actors that voiced him, and then eventually it became Temuera Morrison later on in the timeline. But yeah, I really like how they're doing that, and I just wanted to bring that up real quick. I think we brought it up last week, but I wanted to do it again and go further into detail, because I think I brought it up and like, oh, hey, Katie Sackhoff's got a co-starring thing now, which I think is awesome, because she's as we can see here, she's just as big of a main character in this episode as Din is. So it's
this episode cemented her co-lead status for sure.
And it also threw away any of those like villain doubts that I had. I'm like, we're going to throw those in the ball and go. Because all the lines I was worried about from the trailers that she's going to be a villain were in this episode, and they were not sinister at all. So I'm like, boom, there we go. We're safe. I love when he was like going lower into the city with a jetpack. I just thought the way they shot that was such a great way of doing it, and it was
the cinematography was really good. Like, Rachel Morrison
this year,
I think this
is her first time
debut
directing
anything
for Star Wars, and I
she's
such a great job.
Oh, absolutely.
I haven't seen, as far as I'm aware, I haven't seen any of her prior. I've got to look up what she's done, but
I'm going to have to do the same. But like, this was a very strong debut for Rachel. She played her cinematographer. She has experience as a cinematographer, and you can so tell in the way shots are composed.
Worked with Ryan Coogler a lot. So she was the cinematographer for Black Panther and Fruitvale Station.
Wow.
So, and Dope and
that explains a lot.
So she's done a lot of good stuff. So
yeah,
it's all making a lot of sense because this looks so good. And I believe this is her directorial. That's not true. She did The Morning Show. She did American Crime Story. So she's done a bit of directing on TV at least. So what a directorial debut here.
Yeah,
she did a great job, and the fact that this is one of my new favorite episodes of the show, like, hats off to you. Like, you did a great job, because, like, it's so curious now because of how season one went, where, like, we have our staple of, like, Mando directors. So every time someone new was introduced, we saw this with Book of Boba Fett as well. It's like, oh, I'm curious how they're going to be. Like, we don't, like, know what to expect with them. And then, boom, they surprise us with stuff like this. So that was awesome. Because, like, yes, I love having Rick Famuyiwa back with an increased workload this season because his episode last week was great. But I'm glad to see other new directors in the director's chair as well. As we also get further, go ahead.
Star Wars episodes. Yeah, sorry. Also, Star Wars episodes directed by women, especially in The Mandalorian, she's keeping up the streak of Star Wars episodes, of Mandalorian episodes directed by women, kicking all kinds of ass.
Yeah, it was International Women's Day, I think, 2 days ago at this point. So
yeah, like exactly. It was a great way to herald that, if you know what I mean.
Exactly. Like, Bryce Dallas Howard will always have my heart, her and Deborah Chow, but like, if we can get more and more people on that level,
yeah,
I'm 100% for
exactly.
that.
Exactly. More As women in Star Wars, both in front of and behind
please,
the camera.
Please, give us something at Celebration.
Yes.
Although, I guess we can bring up the fact that apparently the Feige movie and Rogue Squadron are currently dead or no longer in active development. Right? The timing was horrible because I watched on Monday, to end off my birthday, I watched Top Gun Maverick for the first time. And I was like, it's so fucking good. And
it's
I was
so
like,
good.
If they just retool Rogue Squadron to where it's just this movie, I will have literally zero complaints. Because in a way, a lot of Top Gun Maverick is just A New Hope, but it works so well. So it's like,
that was my thoughts.
Rogue
yeah.
Squadron is just Top Gun Maverick, I'll be okay with it. And then, oh yeah, Patty Jenkins and Kevin Feige's movies are no longer in development. And I'm like, all right, cool. Feige, I get. He probably wants to focus all his efforts on Marvel at the moment because people
Fair
are
like, enough.
You slipping, even though I'm like, we can have that discussion.
Plus, the writer was Michael Waldron. Was Waldron. Michael Waldron, who did Multiverse of Madness, and he's now been tapped
he's
to write
Secret War. Secret or is it Kang Dynasty, or is it Secret War that he's writing?
Jeff Loveness is doing Kang Dynasty, and then I believe Michael Waldron is tackling Secret Wars. So it makes
they're
sense.
Like, yeah, we got to focus on this and not Star Wars. Yeah. So I get it. Patty Jenkins, I know Wonder Woman 84 wasn't that good. I didn't particularly Same. Like it. Pedro Pascal was great, but I didn't particularly like it. So if that's why they're like, I hope they... I know it was like Patty's like project. Like, I think she was the one that pitched it and wanted to make that movie. But if they can eventually get that thing off the ground with another director, I would be okay with it because like an X-Wing pilot movie, like it's never been my favorite aspect of Star Wars, but I will never complain if we get more of it. And I just think a movie like that in like a Top Gun style would be super cool. And the fact that like, a movie like Maverick happened where it has a lot of these Star Wars elements, like the cockpit shots and like the Death Star trench run, but in real life, like,
yeah,
it can work. And you could definitely have a very entertaining movie about that, especially if you have like Poe or Wedge in the Maverick role. I think it would work tremendously. So
that would be awesome.
We'll see. The studio showcase panel this year, I think, is going to be incredibly exciting because a lot of the stuff is going to be brand new information. And I am looking forward to that a lot. But we have our Celebration coverage next month to look forward to, where none of us will be there. But as we get further into the city, We get down to the lower levels. We're about to get closer to the mines, and then Din is just immediately grabbed by this giant spider mech thing. At first, I was like, is this like a weird crab droid thing? Like, is this just like a modified crab droid? And then I'm like, no, it's got like an eye to it or whatever.
Yeah.
He's just taken away.
Great jump scare for starters.
It got me. I looked away for half a second, and I just heard boom. And I'm like, what the hell did I miss? And I had to rewind, and I just see giant spider droid kidnapping Din.
It's such a neat trick as well, because Rachel Morrison, and this is where I think her experience with cinematography comes into play, is because she uses a good trick where usually with that kind of stuff, you would cut to a wide shot of Din before the droid snaps over him. But what she actually does here is it happens while the close up of the Mando helmet is still going on.
Yes,
so it really takes you by surprise.
He's looking at the fallen, buried Mando helmet. And I'm like, this is a cool visual. Boom, spider kidnapped, and then Grogu has to save the day. Which this little interlude in the episode where it's just the Grogu adventure. Oh, he has got a couple different noises in this episode. I was losing it, bro. I was like, my guy is just all up there. Grogu capitalism invaded my birthday earlier in the week, I must say. There were Grogu napkins. I did not know how it happened. But it's like, he's here, and I can't escape him. But when he's zoom it, because he's like, we see him just like waddle through like the little creepy like droid spider gross alien thing. His like lair is Din's just like on like a rotisserie or whatever the fuck it is. Like he's like, kid, go get Bo-Katan.
Yeah. And he just starts zooming. Stuck him with a needle as well. Yeah. Like
trying to design. Get his blood or something. I don't know what it is. People have said it would fit right in with like the prequels, and I agree with you.
It really does.
I don't know what it is, design, but it's creepy.
The exosuit is very kind of like a crab droid, like you said, and the design of the creature itself is very, the cyborg like design is very, it's reminiscent of General Grievous, but it doesn't feel like a lesser version. It was very creepy. It kind of reminded me of like the Frenzy robot from the 2007 Transformers film, like especially when the head later on like detaches from the body. But it's very creepy just overall. Like you mentioned the human eye behind the plating, and the image of all those Mandalorian helmets just scattered over the floor. It's a very dark image, and it conjures to mind like, oh, how many Mandalorians have been lured here to Mandalore with like the promise of maybe, I don't know, attaining something from their homeworld, only to fall into this creature's clutches. And there's also an interesting bit as well where it's taking Din's weapon away, and they linger on a shot of it taking the Darksaber off him and throwing it to the floor. And it's a kind of like it's a seemingly throwaway moment, but it kind of reinforces the themes that this show is building upon constantly, of like how the Mandalorians' adherence to some of their traditions is what's holding them back. Because like you've had all of this hubbub about, oh, the Darksaber has to be won in combat, it has to be like used the right way. But as we see, this droid takes it and throws it away, treats it as nothing. Like just a everyday weapon to be disarmed from its opponent, and as we later on see, like it kind of calls into question like whether this is like, well, we've all kind of known that the like, oh, it has to be one in combat thing is bullshit, because it's very clearly just holding back the Mandalorians as a whole. But it was just an interesting moment, and the droid is just like, so the cyborg creature is just really creepy,
very unsettling. It didn't get any better throughout the whole episode. I'm just like, you're terrifying, please get off my screen. But as he just starts, go ahead,
what do you think it was it wanted Din, it was, what do you think it was trying to take from Din? Like, what do you think it was?
We see a lot of like Mandalorian helmets like in his lair.
And it sticks the tubes into him, doesn't it? Like, and it takes tries to take a bit of his blood, I think. I feel like it wanted his blood, like it wanted fluids from him to sustain itself, because it kind of looks like it has some organ sacs similar to Grievous, and I feel like that's kind of the grim thing that it's been surviving down there and just sustaining itself, feeding off whoever's on, yeah,
these creatures.
It's kind of like a Shelob type thing, I suppose, if we want to continue the Lord of the Rings parallels.
Yeah, I mean, well, I guess we'll never find out, because he's alive for about maybe 5 to 10 more minutes. But Grogu just starts zooming out of there, goes back. He encounters the, what are the creatures called again?
The Alamites, yeah.
The Alamites again.
One of them just drops down.
Corners him. Boom. We just see it flying out. Grogu with the Force. I'm like, okay.
Immediately,
so Luke's
immediately
training
bodies him.
Come in handy. I'm like, this fucking guy right here is just like, he's taking no prisoners. Gets back
and
to
he
the
has
ship.
This moment where he's like, he looks at his hand. He's like, I did that. And he doesn't have to, like rest. Like, it shows how much he has progressed as a character, yeah. Grogu. Like,
I love how he just like takes matters into his own hands too. Cause he notices didn't get kidnapped. He's like, I'm going to see what's up here. Like, I need to save my dad. And I love how we'll get to it, but I love how Bo-Katan keeps referring to Din as Grogu's dad throughout the whole episode.
Yeah. Did you think your dad was the only Mandalorian?
Yeah.
She's very much picked up on that vibe.
Your kid is
sure.
Quite the navigator. And I'm like, yeah. Well, boom. Father and son, we see. But he gets out of there. Him and R5 leave. We cut back to Bo-Katan's throne room. We get the great shot of her just looking down on the throne. I'm like, boom, that's a poster right there. She's like, oh, your majesty, we have an unwanted visitor. And he's like, all right, I'm gonna get rid of this guy once and for all. And I'm like, what does she mean by that? But then we see it just
winds up here, but like her saying, I'm gonna get rid of him once and for all, just kind of winds up saying, I just want to be like, did you not hear me the first time? I want to be left alone, damn it.
I want to be alone, but then immediately she's like, what happened to him? I gotta help.
Yeah,
like immediately, just like protective instinct kicks in when she sees
that
just
moment.
A little guy.
That moment really allayed a lot of my fears, and I feel like this episode as a whole has, like, the first episode was already doing that, but the second episode, this episode has very much confirmed for me that they're going in exactly the direction I were hoping for with Bo-Katan. Like, she's not at all gonna be an antagonistic force. She's gonna basically serve as more of an ally to Din and a co-lead of the series, if anything, because, you know, any like antagonism she feels towards Din immediately melts away the minute she knows that he's in danger, and that when she sees Grogu in the pod, the way Katie Sackhoff's voice just changes when she talks to the droid, like there's a softer quality there. Maybe it's informed by like her own loss that she's gone through, potentially, because we get a little bit of her family history here, which aside from Satine, we've not gotten before, and that's just so cool.
Getting the information about her dad, I thought was awesome.
That was fascinating. I loved hearing about her dad. It's interesting that we didn't get any mention of Satine, but I suppose
maybe they're saving it, or they're like, maybe Dimble
there is that theory
had a sister.
And there is a theory about Bo-Katan where, like, because I know that they've sort of hinted that she is closer in age to Katie Sackhoff than people had thought, because I think people thought, oh, how is she around? She should be like 60 or something. And how does she look as good as she does? Aside from the fact that, well, Katie Sackhoff looks great. And it's like, oh, Mandalorian's age slower. But it seems like they've kind of gone, no, she was actually a lot younger than people thought. Like she was just into her 20s around the Clone Wars. And that's led some people to speculate whether or not she could in fact be Satine's kid. Secret love child with Obi-Wan.
I don't think
that's where they're going. No. It's a fun theory. It's a theory
quirky,
just for fun.
I still might be a quirky truther, but I think like there's a bigger age gap there, because I've seen the
people say
that, like, oh, now we think she was more closer in age to Ahsoka during the Clone Wars than we expected. Again, timeline, it's been a little muddy recently of like...
It has been a little muddy, but yeah.
How long has it been since season 2, and how long has it been since Book of Boba? It's like, maybe we'll get the answers, maybe we won't. Who knows? All I know is I'm fascinated by this Clan Kree's lore dump that we had.
Yeah. I kind of wonder, like, with her father, when she says that her father died defending Mandalore, it makes me kind of think, is that the event? Like, I feel like that was the inciting incident that kind of defined the ideological divide between her and Satine. Like did the fact that he gave his life for Mandalore fighting, did that kind of spur Satine on to become a pacifist? Did it drive Bo-Katan to respect the ancient traditions of her people a lot more in a way of honoring her father? Like, I feel like they both settled on their ideologies as a way of honoring their father, and it just set them off on completely different paths.
It'll be very interesting if we get more detail on that, especially like when it happened, because it's like, was this before or after Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan's mission on Mandalore?
I feel like it would be afterwards. Or maybe it was the same incident. Like, maybe this is...
Why they were there. But again, timeline-wise...
We need a novel, man. We need an exploration. Something.
Like, they've been dangling that carrot of that story for 10, 12 years at this point. Like,
I want to know, damn it.
Give it to us. But, again, I loved seeing... First of all, there are two things. One, shout out Bo-Katan ship. I have a Lego set of it. It was one of those ones where I just never really noticed how cool it was until recently. And I'm like,
yeah.
No,
I also have a Lego gauntlet fighter. I don't have it with me at the moment, but I'm going to make sure I have a hold of it next time we recap. Because we'll be seeing that ship again. But yeah.
Oh, yes, we will. So
I'm so glad to see more of it. I can't believe we have a gauntlet fighter in live action.
It's great.
It's so cool. I can't believe we have Bo-Katan in live action.
It's like, still crazy to me. And I think to me personally, it's been the most seamless animation to live action.
Oh, for sure.
Transition we've had pretty much just because it's been the same actress throughout, but it just feels right. It's like, it's not like Ahsoka where I'm like, is this the same character? It's like with Bo-Katan, it's like, no, like this is the exact same character that we saw in Rebels and Clone Wars. So I'm just so over the moon with how it's turned out so far, but I love seeing her again. It's still crazy to see the, like you mentioned, Bo-Katan's Mandal armor in live action, her fighting the creatures, just double blasters at points, which was awesome. And then point when they get back down and they fight the droid again, when she the little shield gauntlets, I'm in love with those things. But then when she picks up the Darksaber, wields it, and it's like, there's none of that issue that Din has with the heaviness or anything. She's like, all right, I'm wielding it just like it was yesterday. And she takes
the droid out within the cyborg out within 5 seconds. And like, it takes her just barely any longer to like neutralize the giant droid. The slide that she does underneath it, when she cuts like through the underside of it, that was sick. That was awesome. Like, that was such a great action sequence.
In that second, I went from like, yeah, I know it would be cool to see Din have the saber for the rest of the series too. You know, on second thought, like, Din, like, you had a good run, buddy, but I think Bo-Katan needs how to use Mandalore.
I feel like she's going to train him how to use it, because I had thought maybe they would have a Jedi train him to connect with the blade, similar to how, like, Kanan trained Sabine, but it's very possible that she could either train him, or maybe if Sabine is going to make a surprise appearance in this series of The Mandalorian, whether she might wind up instructing him, because that would be kind of a cool cyclical thing. Kanan trained Sabine trained Din, but equally I feel like Bo-Katan could do it as well, because like she clearly knows how to use it, and I feel like after this episode there's definitely a bond being strengthened between these two, and I'm not just saying that because I ship them. I do in fact ship Dinbo. Grogu ships Dinbo as well.
He does.
We've got to talk about like that whole segment prior where like it's just Bo-Katan and Grogu just going through the kind of like previous 10 minutes that him and Din were doing. It's kind of like, it's weird because it's like it's a repeat of the first segment with the two of them going through the mines, but it doesn't feel repetitive because you're actually seeing how Grogu is bringing is not only bringing out this softer side in Din, but also in Bo-Katan. And I can't give enough praise to Katie Sackhoff for her acting, because not only is she really able to invest the character with a sense of weariness and melancholy for the state of her planet, her people, and the divides between them, but the softer tones to her voice when she's speaking to Grogu, and the fact that she's, you know, interacting with Grogu is probably putting her in touch with a part of herself that she hasn't really been in touch with since the end of the Clone Wars. It's a moving thing, to be honest.
Yeah, no, like, again, you're spot on with everything there.
Thanks, man.
And I am just, I loved how they had that little moment to bond together. And she's like, oh, you're quite the navigator. And we have that great conversation where she's like,
yeah,
there was a time period where Mandalorians and Jedi worked really well together during the end of the war. And it's like, oh, I don't know what they told you about us during your training. But well, there was a time, like, where we worked well together. Because
the Armorer called them enemy sorcerers. Like mm-hmm. as far as the Children of the Watch are concerned, the Jedi were the enemy. But Bo knows differently. She's
Jedi?
The Jedi. The Jedi she knows have always been allies. Like, she's fought with Ahsoka and Obi-Wan. And there's again, this shows, I feel like they have. Not only does this kind of cement Bo as like the co-lead by literally pairing her up with Grogu in a similar fashion to Din, but also showing that she is just as protective of Grogu as Din is. Like, when she spots the Alamite hanging over the ceiling, she gently pushes Grogu's cradle out of the way to ensure that he's not hurt. Like, for as much as she puts on a show of like, you know, I'm a big tough Mandalorian. I don't care what I have to do to retake the planet. Bo-Katan is a bit of a softie, just like Din, and I feel like that's potentially what bonds them. I think why she sticks around, and why despite how she clashes with Din's stubborn adherence to what she considers to be like children's fairy tales, she kind of admires him. She admires his dedication, and it kind of slowly inspires her more, up until that huge reveal, in which case I feel like that's like a massive jump start to her aspirations to retaking Mandalore.
Yeah, 100%. Because last week it was, no, I'm done. Like, I'm not gonna retake. I'm done with my mission. And now it's like, maybe I should. Because originally she was like, all right, we need to go. And she's like, no, I need to go to the mines. And she's like, all right, fine, I'll take you there. Whatever. What?
You'd never make it there on your own. Yeah, you'd never make it there on your own.
You're going to die. And then we'll just cut right to the mines. And again, I just love how she's just so like sarcastically reading like a little like tourist plate. Like, oh, Mandalore the Great, yada, 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 bathed in these mines. The creed, this is the way, like all the talking points she's just reading, and meanwhile Din is just like so entrenched in it, just looking. And then we see him just like take his scarf off, doesn't take any of the Beskar off. I'm like, all right, cool, whatever, buddy. And as he's like reciting the code, boom, falls down. And I don't know if like he was something dragged him down there, or if like the weight of the armor just like sunk him immediately.
Given how much of a himbo Din is
down there, yeah,
I feel like that either option is possible for sure.
He's like, yeah, you got like 50 pounds of armor on you, dude. Like, yeah, you're gonna just sink immediately. So Bo-Katan dives after him, rescues him, and as they're swimming up, they come across a giant creature. And they see an eye open, and the camera pans, and it's a freaking mythosaur.
I just can't believe we got a freaking mythosaur.
How do they end with that, man?
Oh, it was perfect though. Like, I just the way they did it, like the slow pan up, like showing the eye and the tusk, like the design of it. I have to say, they did such a great job at communicating what it is visually. Because yes, they had Bo-Katan read off on the plaque, like, before, this used to be a Mythosaur lair, like, just mm-hmm. to, like, kind of tee it up. And I feel like a lot of savvy people
armor, mentioned the Mythosaur in, like, the previously on section.
Yeah. It's exactly. Like, there's enough there to tee up a viewer who's paying attention. Like, I kind of was thinking, are we going to see something with the Mythosaur when that popped up in the previously section? But the way it's done is brilliant as well. Like, there's no room for doubt what it is. I love that when the light fades, just as the light fades, when Bo-Katan goes out of frame and it turns away, you can see the silhouette of its face and how perfectly that matches the now iconic signet of the Mandalorian. It's perfectly done, and it just sends a shudder, because it's like, oh my god, like, this is a, like, whether you believe in the aspects of the creed or not, this is a huge deal, like, because these things are supposed to have been extinct for millennia, and mm-hmm. like, just that how one of them is even there is enough of a cool thing and enough of a cool mystery to unravel. But also, what does this now mean for all of the various Mandalorians? This is kind of, I imagine, what the rest of the series is now going to be, because I feel like Din is ideologically on board with retaking Mandalore now that he has redeemed himself in the eyes of his clan. But I feel like Bo-Katan has absolutely now had her desire to retake Mandalore been rejuvenated, because what better omen to come to all the different coverts with than there's a freaking Mythosaur in the mines, I saw it with my own eyes. Like,
I saw a tweet, it's like, Din's gonna end up tripping and falling over and landing on its back and then end up pulling Mandalore that way.
It's literally gonna be the ending of the Disney Sword of the Stone thing, where he's like, I don't know anything about being the Mandalore.
Exactly. Yeah. But great way to end the episode, just that boom reveal.
It's incredible.
I was like, oh my god.
And it like, throws everything up in the air as well. Like, because we thought that, like, it gave the impression, the trailers did, that the whole series would be structured around Din getting to Mandalore. We've got there within the second episode, and we haven't even had like an inkling of what the Empire is doing. Like, it's very possible that the Empire probably still has unfinished business on Mandalore as well, and
I'm sure we'll be back here. Yeah.
I feel like we're not done on Mandalore by a long stretch, for sure.
But like, that was just, what a way to end the episode. And like you said, I have no idea what's coming for the rest of the season now,
because exactly.
They just threw us a curveball like this. So yeah, the adventures of Din and Bo-Katan and their navigator's son have continued here, and now they found a dinosaur in the lake. So this will be interesting of how it goes going forward. But we have a lot to be excited about for the rest of the season. I think we can wrap things up here now. It was a great episode. Two back-to-back bangers of an episode this week for Star Wars TV. As I mentioned in the Bad Batch recap that will be out tomorrow, I was originally against the fact that we're getting both shows airing on the same day. Just because I was worried that Mando was going to overshadow Bad Batch the whole time. But if we're going to keep getting episodes like this the whole time, I suddenly have less of an issue about it than I did.
Yeah. Because I said last week, this was a great day to be a Star Wars fan. I feel like this week just came along and said, hold my beer.
Yeah.
Because it makes me kind of feel like, what's next week going to be like? Like, what kind of stuff are we going to get?
Last week we got a Zillow Beast. This week we get a Mythosaur. Next week we're going to get
the redemption of Crosshair.
Palpatine. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's just crazy. But thank you for joining us for our recaps of The Mines of Mandalore. Like you said, very Lord of the Rings title here. But it was a great adventure nonetheless.
Mines of Mandalore.
Don, where can the people find you?
Okay, so you can find me on Twitter at Donovan Mead, where I tweet a lot about Star Wars, also some Marvel, Doctor Who, occasionally politics as well. You can also find me on TikTok at Donovan McComish, same handle on Hive as well. You can find me on Instagram at Donovan_McComish. And like Connor and Andrew, you can find me on SWEditorIG.com, where we write articles about Star Wars, obviously. My most recent article was a while ago. It was about where a potential Kenobi season 2 could go. And in addition to those, we also all are part of what we call SWEF, Star Wars Edited Fiction, which is a collection of short stories and web comics that are essentially fan stories that try to adhere to what is established in canon, whilst also repurposing and trying to fit in some stuff from Legends where we can as well. Just trying, you know, because everything is, it's cool to have everything included. I have written one story that came out in June last year. It's called Scars of War. It stars a clone trooper called Blister who survived Order 66, and he meets a Jedi survivor of that same event who's called Sharkoon, and they both have to face an oncoming threat that involves confronting their past trauma, so to speak. So if you like Star, I've said this before, if you like Star Wars and pain, be sure to check it out.
Yeah, we love a good Star Wars pain story. Definitely so. As for myself, you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok at Starlight Andrew, same username there. Post a lot of fun stuff. As usual, you can find the podcast on Twitter at For the Repub Pod and on Instagram and TikTok at For the Republic Pod. We'll have some updates on what we're going to be posting, what our schedule is going to be like going forward. So check that out. Also subscribe to our YouTube page, For the Republic Podcast. Just look it up. We are a little bit short of our halfway mark for our goal to start doing some live streaming content. So help us out there, boost those numbers up, and just, you know, engage with the videos. Help us out there. Give us a rate and a like on Google, the Google App Store and the Apple App Store. That will help us out a lot in terms of growth and engagement with the podcast. Get more people listening and get more people involved with our Star Wars journey. Clone Wars, our Clone Wars show is coming back at some point. We'll get to it. It's coming soon.
Yeah, it's coming. It is
potentially next
coming.
Week. Potentially, we're going to talk about Ryloth. We got to. I personally have to rewatch the episodes again, but we'll get there again. And then
Ryloth isn't all white whale. I swear.
Exactly. And then next week, again, just a quick reminder of our podcast schedule. So next Friday, you'll see our Mando recap. Next Saturday, our Bad Batch recap as well. So stay tuned for that. And Bad Batch tomorrow. And as always, we'll see you guys later. And this is the way.